Hey everybody, Anthony Avillo here, Fire Ground Strategies and Other Stuff from the Street. You know, that siren made me feel like I was going to be pushed back against the wall. You know, years ago, I'd hear a siren like that. Oh my God, here they come. Now I got to be up against the wall. That's a story for another day. We are live from the FDIC, 2020 or 2021. It's weird because the Olympics is 2020. FDIC should have been 2020, but now 2020. We're live currently as we speak from the FDIC. So I have a special guest and a distant guest. My distant guest is not really a guest. It's my good buddy and grandbrother, Jim Duffy, and he will speak in a second. And we are very fortunate to have a very good friend, retired Chief of Sacramento, Anthony Castros.
Hello, hello.
Hello, my brother.
Thank you.
So our good friend Jim Duffy is not with us here at the conference, but we do have him on the phone. So he say a few words, Duff, and you take it away.
Hello to Anthony Squared. I'm glad to have this time at FDIC, although it's only virtual time. Sorry to all the folks there that I couldn't be there for my class yesterday. I had a family emergency and was not available. But I'm so happy that Anthony's filling in for me. Hopefully he can make me look good. And to all the folks at FDIC, recharge your battery, go to as many classes as you can, bring stuff home, and be grateful that you're part of this great brotherhood and sisterhood. I am deeply missing it, but it's not as important as what I've got going on here. So remember, always do the right thing and enjoy your time at FDIC. And if you're home, listen to all these podcasts. You can pick something up here, too. And anyway, Anthony, I'll see you next month when we do our show live. Until then, everybody at FDIC, miss you and love you. Bye-bye.
Love you, brother. Thank you, Duff. Love you, brother, and totally miss you here, man. And now for the very first time, I'm actually going to be on my own on this radio show. I don't have
Duff. Wait a second. You're not alone?
No. I mean without you. I don't think I've ever done this show without you.
Oh, wow. I don't know.
That's pretty significant right there.
Yeah,
I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, I don't think
some big shoes I'm floating in.
You are floating in some very big shoes.
Oh, come on. But anyway, you guys, I'm going to sign off and enjoy the show. And if you still have classes left to do, enjoy them. And tell everybody I said, hey.
Thanks, Doc.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, love you, man. All right, so that was our good friend Jim Duffy, chief in Connecticut. Couldn't make it here this year. And you know, we wish him well, wish him and his family well, and, you know, hopefully we will see him soon. But instead of being solo by myself, because I'm just not that interesting, I have my good buddy Anthony Castro here, and he's retired as well as I am, but we both probably do way too much work as retired guys. And it's a pleasure to have you here, brother.
Thanks, brother. It's great to be here. You know, Duff said something that's near and dear to my heart and how much we all love FDIC. And I think the biggest thing is where we come to kind of get rejuvenated, you know, and we get to be around like-minded nuts and wackos who love this job. And here we are, a couple of retired nitwits who are still doing it, you know, teaching. You know, we'll probably both be doing it until there's like one person left in our class. As long as there's one person left, we'll be 105 years old, and somebody will be still coming to hear what a couple guys like us have to say. But it's an honor to be here with you, brother. I think you and I've talked a lot about getting together and about talking and about sharing, and so this is great.
Yeah, we've been talking a long time about getting together and just doing either a podcast or something. Yeah. And here we are. So first of all, tell us about the classes that you're doing here at the FDIC.
Well, like you, I did a class already. I did a 4-hour workshop yesterday. It was called Aggressive Command and Tactics. It was a great time. Had a lot of great people and interaction. And that's kind of a precursor to another one that I'm doing later this week. I've got two more classroom sessions. And one of them is called Civilian Rescue, The Reason We Exist. And that's co-taught with Brian Brush. And he and I are really trying to emphasize not overemphasize or say that it's more important, but bring statistical analysis, data, information, attention to civilian rescues, much in the way we've done for the past 20 years with RIC and rapid intervention and firefighter safety and survival, all important things. They're not mutually exclusive. And for those of you who have the article or have the this month's edition of Fire Engineering, it's one of the articles, same name, Civilian Rescue, the Reason We Exist. And there's some pretty compelling data in there that we that's been harvested from Brian and his folks at Firefighter Rescue Survey.com. And so that class is going to be Thursday. And then before that, I got one more on leadership and succession planning. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it's going to be a busy week. How about you? You got another one?
Yeah. So you got three classes this year?
Oh, here we go.
Wow. You know, you're not as good as Galliano because I think he had four. But man, three classes. Look at you. You know, it's always the West Coast guys that get that special preference, man.
No, it doesn't count. I'm just riding the coattails of Brian Brush.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's probably his, you know, he put in and then it's just you and him. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. Yeah. I did. Just this morning, I did the full contact leadership from the firehouse to the streets. And I really had a good time. It's a class that I really enjoy teaching and it changes every time I do it.
Yeah.
I started it out as a class with Ed Flood, who I wrote that book with, the Full Contact Leadership book. Yeah. And, you know, he was like my mentor and he passed away last year.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
But every time I teach it, it just changes a little bit. We actually had a really good time teaching it today. I had a really good audience and they were really engaged and it was nice. I'm happy that my evaluations were all really good.
Okay.
So I was really happy for that because it's sort of the first time I've done the 4-hour trip for that particular class.
Oh, great.
You know,
it's based on the book.
It's based on a Full Contact Leadership book.
Great book.
Yeah. It's actually it's interesting because it is based on the book, and a lot of stuff in the class is not in the book. It's almost like, you know, I was actually thinking of writing another small sort of addendum to it based around this class.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of lazy now.
Is it different because of the questions you get or the feedback you get or people say, hey, can you cover this? Is that why the class is different than the book?
No. When we first put the class together 2 years ago, it was only a short session. And we didn't want to just sort of throw out a highlights of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was we used a little bit of the book, but we started to branch off into like personnel issues and that sort of thing. And it was really cool because we kind of went into a direction where we talk about issues that you might encounter as a chief officer and how you need to be able to forecast storm clouds brewing. We talked about like catching stuff in the incipient phase because if we likened it to the stages of fire.
Yeah.
So, you know, the higher up you go, like you catch it in growth or flashover or fully developed, you know, the more tools you need, the more injury to the organization, you know, so we went in that direction. And then what we did was how to sort of fix those problems. We utilized fire ground tactics.
Love it.
Like forcible entry and locate and search and ventilate and salvage and extinguish. And, you know, so we correlated all of the activities you would do, you know, a personnel issue and counseling sessions in with these fire tactic sort of things. So we said, you know, we want to try and make it a way that people can sort of understand it.
Yeah.
And make it easier for them to digest. So we said, you know, what easier than, you know, going right into the tactics and stuff.
I think that's brilliant because like you said, firefighters, they relate so much to tactics. We think tactically and when you relate anything else, the less fun stuff, the stuff that we don't like, not the hands-on forcible break stuff, fire.
Right.
It's when you say, oh crap, I don't want to deal with personnel issues or counseling or heaven forbid discipline or whatever, but you liken it to what we do love, like forcible entry or, you know, tactics. I think it's a brilliant crossover. It's a natural fit for firefighters.
It kind of is. And I think On the evaluations, that's some of the things that the guys like the most. Yeah. They like the fact that, you know, we're using terms that they can understand, but we're using them in a different context.
Incipient. And they know what that means.
Yeah, exactly. So it was actually pretty good. And I got a lot of great feedback on it. So and I just did it in a couple other places too. I was out in Alaska. I did it out there. And, you know, like I said, it just, as I think of stuff and hear about stuff, it kind of just keeps sort of, you know, moving forward and morphing into another class. And, you know, that's why I probably like all my class, I have like 75 versions of each class.
Exactly.
And I got to look at the dates on what they, where they
exactly,
were.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You because keep tweaking it, always tweaking it.
You keep tweaking it. And then what I found was when I tweak it again, now I'll use the same name, but I'll put the date after
that's
it.
Smart. Yeah.
You know, and say, okay, I know this was the last sort of morph.
Right.
Of that class, you know,
and you know, the next one's going to be version, whatever else.
So it's pretty interesting. And tomorrow after the opening session, I have the command and control class.
Good.
Short sessions are hard.
They're hard
because I have too much information.
So much to cram in that little
and not enough time, man.
Even
not
4 hours time. Is hard for the kind of stuff we're talking about. But hour and 45 is like, it's like a fart in the wind. But you know what? What I love about this guy, I guess we're on camera. If what I love about this guy is that he is like one of the most prolific writers. I mean, I can't believe this guy's got his master's degree. He's written all these books. He writes his second edition before the first edition comes out. Whenever he writes a book, the third edition's out before the second edition's out. It's crazy. I'm like, how does he come up with new stuff? But it's
take notes.
Well, you've got that rare combination, which I think is like a unicorn in our job sometimes, where you have this, and this is from the heart here. You have that rare combination of incredible street credit, having done it with a huge heart who cares about the troops, but you have a really good academic approach where you can prolifically write all these books and articles and put it together classes. You don't see that very often.
Mm-hmm.
So even though all of the content is crap, I think the ability to put it out there is just magic.
It's just a bunch of drivel.
Drivel.
It's total drivel. Well, I'm working now on the fourth edition of the book, the strategies book, and I wasn't going to write it. I happened to be in a van coming from from Tulsa. And I luckily, really fortunate, I got to sit next to Brunicini in the van for like an hour going to the airport. And it was a month before he passed away. And, you know, he asked me about the book and he said, you know, you're thinking about doing another edition. I said, nah, the last one, they should have called it the last edition. And, you know, why would you do that? You know, why would you have the brand? And, you know, the book is still successful and you're still writing and you're still out in the field. Why would you? So, you know, Alan Brunicini sort of gave me the sort of motivation to, it was, it really was. Cause I really never had a great sit down talk with him like I did that day. And he motivated me to do that. I'll put a little thing in the, you know, in the dedications and the forwards,
absolutely.
And, you know, to him, you know,
and this book wouldn't exist if it wasn't for that conversation.
No, definitely not. And he gave me, you know, a lot of inspiration to do it. And, it was, it was really cool. It was really cool. And, so, you know, right now it's I'm about halfway done. My third edition is jammed with notes and stickies and, you know, and you're just trying to like wade your way through it to kind of get the finished product.
Keep the really good stuff, but added all the new stuff. And
I actually dumped a lot of stuff out, but then you look at it and you say, well, I got to keep this in, I got to keep that in. And now you're starting to say, well, now this book's going to get bigger again,
right.
Listen, to all you guys who actually had to read this book for a promotion or a class, I'm really sorry, because I know it's a dredge, it is a dredge. But, you know, listen, thank you for the kind words, brother. It's all good.
You know, it was one of those things. Speaking of Bruno, he was like you. He was a huge influence on my career and my life. I met him for the first time at FDIC West in 2000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he was out there and I followed his work for a long time before I met him, obviously. And I was, you know, I think I just made the captain's list maybe, or was a captain or something. And I volunteered to be his hall monitor, you know, the AV guy,
cool.
Just, you know, but anything to be close to this legend, you know? And so I'm in the classroom and here he comes walking in, you know, and it's like, here comes Yoda, you know, and
the big flowered shirt.
Oh yeah, with the shirt and everything. And I I just introduced myself and here, I'm here to help you. And after the first, at the first break, I couldn't contain myself anymore. So I grabbed his little face and I kissed him on the forehead. Couldn't help myself. And he goes, "What was that for?" And I go, "Because you're a beautiful man." And he goes, "Do you drink?" I go, "Yes." He goes, "We'll get along just fine then."
Oh my God.
And even though he didn't drink, you know, it was the beginning of an amazing relationship with a legend and an icon. And he, like, as you know, probably from your conversation, he's just so humble, approachable, and real. And you're talking to this guy, and there's no ego there.
No ego, no pretense.
No, nothing. Nothing. And I was very blessed to have developed a really great relationship and friendship with him. He wrote the foreword to my first book. That was so powerful. I remember when we got the first copy and it arrived at our house, my wife was reading this forward.
Wait, the one you just...
The first Assessment Center edition. Yeah.
When was that?
That came out in 2006.
Okay, I don't have that book.
Yeah, that's the first edition. Second edition came out in 18.
Yeah, no, that one I have.
Because you're in it.
Yeah.
And so that one, the first one, he wrote the forward. And I remember when we first got our first copy, you know, I'm this new author, like, oh my gosh,
isn't amazing. That cool?
It's an amazing feeling.
Yeah.
So any of you out there, if they can publish a couple of nitwits like us, they could publish you. So I was talking to Tom Papa today, or not Tom Papa. That's a comedian. Yeah. Nick Papa.
There's a comedian, Tom Papa?
Not always great. Yeah.
Okay.
So Nick Papa about...
He's a comedian too.
Yeah, he is. He just came out with his new book on Revelation. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so my wife's reading this forward from Bruno to me. And she just starts bawling because she had met him and knew how much he meant to me. And I would always call him when I was going through my tough seasons as a chief officer. You start like, okay, you redefine. Okay, what am I? Who am I? Is this chief officer thing? I'm not one of the guys anymore. And then you start having personality issues. You just, you know, like, yeah, this stuff you're talking just about.
Stuff, yeah.
This, this stuff, the crap you deal with. And he would always be that. He was my 1-800 number. He was my
oh, wow.
phone a friend. And he always answered it. It's like, is he not teaching a class? No, he'd be in a class or something. If he didn't answer right away, he called back, it seemed like within minutes.
Yeah.
And it was an honor to have to call him a mentor and a friend. I've got a picture of me in my office at home, of me and him, me kissing his forehead.
Oh God.
another class or something.
Yeah, I have the picture. And when I saw him, he asked me about the strategies book, and I showed him the leadership book. And I handed it to him, sure, and he just held on to it. And I said, "All right, well, I'm not getting that one back."
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, "Listen, that's a gift to you, you know." But he was just, you know, and in my class, in this leadership class I do, one of the first slides is a clip of Brunicini, and he's now Brunicini or Brunicini?
Brunicini.
It is Brunicini. See, when I thought it was always Brunicini because that's the Italian pronunciation.
Right.
But,
right.
It's like fettuccine.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So,
but there's only one C. That's a thing.
There's only one C.
Yeah. Okay. She's like, "What are you guys talking about?"
Maybe
so,
one.
So yeah. Here's the thing about him that one of the biggest things I learned was he was always like you just said it. He grabbed your book and he wouldn't let go.
Yeah.
A month before he passed, he was always a student.
Yes.
He always wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about him, and you could see it, the reason why he was so respected was because no matter what accolades or rank or status or legend he achieved in our world, he never took himself that seriously. Mm-hmm. And he always wanted to learn from the next folks coming up and what's going on. And
he read the books.
He read all the books, and he was a student of everyone. It was really, and that was a very, very prevalent impression upon me. Mm-hmm. It was really like, whoa, he really does actually care about what
absolutely.
Anybody, when you talk to him, you know this, right? You know he's actually listening. He's not checking his phone. He's not checking his watch. He's not thinking about something else. He's absolutely he's asking questions.
Yeah.
And I think from speaking of leadership, I think that's an aspect that we all a lesson we can all learn as leaders. I think God gave us two ears, two nostrils, and two eyes for a reason, because those all take in information.
They take in.
And God said, "Hey, this is twice as important as this thing on your face and that other thing at the back end. Those put out information, and it's usually about the same quality." So just keep that in mind.
About the same quality. Oh my God, that is great, man. That is. Where'd you hear that? How'd you make that one up?
I don't know. I don't know.
That was really good.
Thank you.
That was very, you want to talk about prolific, man. Oh, stop. That is very good. But yeah, so I have a video I use from Brunicini in my leadership class, and I just sort of came across it, and I use it in my classes now, whenever I'm dealing with leadership stuff. And it was about personal responsibility, you know, and no matter how many policies and procedures and rules and regs and all that a department has, it still doesn't trump somebody without personal responsibility because, exactly. You know, listen, you know, you're heading towards that red light and you're sitting in the right front seat as a captain. You are just hoping all the things you taught this guy about safety and drivers, safety, everything else is going to kick in as he approaches that intersection. And, right. You know, you don't have control over that, yeah. You know, and that's what Brunicini was talking about, you know, and I spend a good amount of time in that area at the beginning of my class, because no matter how good an officer you are or how influential you are, if you're dealing with people that don't have personal responsibility, it's hard to trust what they're going to do.
Exactly. You know, so how do we instill that in them? How do we instill, is there a seed or a sapling of that you can see in somebody, like a new aspiring officer, that you say, okay, I'm going to cultivate that to help this firefighter who wants to be an officer, this new officer, mm-hmm. take seriously the personal responsibility they need to have for this job. How do we do that as leaders?
I think it's one of those, it's sort of one of those gray areas. I think number one, you got to know your people.
Exactly.
That's the most important thing, but it's also like, you know, personal responsibility is one of those things. You know it when you see it,
yeah.
And you know it when you don't.
Yeah.
But sometimes you, depending on a situation, somebody you thought was going to do something the right way, you know, sometimes they teeter on the other end, you know, and it's like, you know, it's like, you know, searching or something, you know, right. where, you know, you have two guys in a search, what's the stop in a zero visibility, one guy going into another room because he can,
right.
You know, what's going to stop that?
Right.
Nothing's going to stop. The only thing to stop that is the guy's sense of personal responsibility and duty,
right.
And all the things you've instilled in him,
right.
As an officer, you know, as his officer and, you know, in the rules and regs of the department, you just got to hope that stuff kicks in at that sort of moment of truth. And, you know, I think that's what he was talking about and sort of what that means. Cause he was talking about, you know, you're the one riding backwards. You're the one going in and putting these fires out. And, you know, you have to have some sort of like personal accountability for yourself, mm-hmm. and personal responsibility. But I thought it was really cool. You know, we had an incident at the fire academy and we were doing vent end to search on, in firefighter one class, and it was over like a weekend, and we put like 60 kids through the training, and we had taught them about it, showed them video out on a fire ground, we demonstrated it, like we did everything we had,
yeah,
to do, and then what was happening is, you know, the kids were waiting to go and do this operation, you know, they're watching,
yeah.
So the operation was, you had a ground ladder up to the window, and it's an academy where, you know, you open the, you know,
right.
So they had to simulate breaking,
right.
the glass.
Right.
So the plan was go up the ladder, simulate breaking the glass, sweep the floor, mm-hmm. victims, sound the floor, stability, place the tool, slither in, and take care of the search.
Right.
So like 52, 53 kids did it right. There's one kid, like, we don't know what he was thinking about, but he goes up the ladder, he simulates breaking the glass, sweeps the floor, sounds the floor, instead of putting the tool down, dives in, hits the instructor in the face with the Halligan tool, rips the whole front of his, you know, like his whole eye apart. But you looked at that and you say, at that moment, when that guy did that, you don't have control.
Right.
You just don't have control over him. And all you can do is hope that he listened, he absorbed, you know, and you look and you said, well, whether he listened or absorbed, that the personal responsibility factor just wasn't there. So then you look at it and say, you know, how, you know.
Is it, my question, because I love what you're saying, I'm picturing this kid, I'm picturing all this happening.
Mm-hmm.
Is it responsibility, or could it have just been, hey, you know, he's got a problem with attention to detail. He got mm-hmm. nervous. He got,
yeah.
distracted.
Mm-hmm.
So he has the personal, he has a responsibility. He wants to do a good job. He, mm-hmm. he's there to do a good job, but he just screwed up.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, of course,
you know,
of course. But the point, I agree with that, because yeah, it could have been any one of these things. But the point that that I was looking at, that to me is the most important part, not necessarily, but at that moment where you have no control over them,
yeah,
you know,
you're relying on all that other,
you're
stuff.
Relying on all that stuff to kick in,
yeah.
And yeah, and there may be many different factors,
attitude,
that
training,
that do that, yeah,
all the things that,
but you're
that,
relying on, you're relying that on, and yeah. You know, you don't know if you know, at that moment of truth, you know, what can happen,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I thought that was one of the things Brunicini was talking about with that, that, you know, you just don't know. And you have to trust.
You have to trust.
Sometimes, yeah. You know?
And then even if something bad happens like that, it can the trust sustain the event mm-hmm. and get on the backside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's find out what happened. Let's not ruin this kid or ruin the relationship or whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and then yeah. sustain the trust through mm-hmm. the event and on the backside and help them learn from it.
Yeah, it was just, you know, interesting. And that's sort of what I got out of that. And then I've seen, you know, as I see it, I look at it like there's another video that I show and it's a North Hudson video. Actually, it wasn't my fire, but it's a guy going up the ladder and he's got the saw in his hand. And there's a fire building and there's smoke coming out from down below. And as he gets to the top of the ladder, now everybody will tell you, and you know, in fire one, sound a roof. Mm-hmm. He just jumps on a roof, jumps on a roof. And this is a guy that's got some time on the job. So I think complacency issues are there. Yeah. And this is where you talk about personal responsibility, yeah. But he jumped off the ladder onto the roof. And you know, this is where I say, like, and I stop it. I go like, this is the point. Well, you have no control over this guy.
Right.
And what he's going to do, he's going to have to deal with the consequences. And the guy just like jumps off the ladder onto the roof, you know, and you say, well, how do you stop that? You can't.
You can't.
You can't. All you can do is hope that all the things that we've taught him and the rules and the regs and all the sort of things that we've instilled in this guy kick in at that moment. And it's probably even more important when you're in the right front seat and the guy's speeding towards the red light at the busy intersection.
Well, and you know, to your point, you're talking about the right front seat, but then there's the left front seat of leadership, i.e. mm-hmm. you're in chief.
Mm-hmm.
And like in my system, I didn't have a driver.
Me neither.
Okay, so you and I both come from that world where you go from spending your entire career being around other firefighters, other mm-hmm. nitwits who you can either blame your mistakes on or who can help keep you out of trouble, right?
Right.
Save you from yourself. Right. And then after whatever, 15, 20 years of that, the academy, dinners, we're on the rig working out, you're thrust into this solo place called chief officer, battalion mm-hmm. chief, for example. And I found out, I found it to be such an interesting and sudden transition, like going from a hot tub to an ice cold swimming pool, because you talk about this responsibility and entrusting your troops. Now you go from like a supervisory leadership style where as in that you're with the people you're leading, you're physically with them. Now you're a battalion chief. You're not physically with the people
No.
you're leading for the first time in your entire career. And you're by yourself in the rig. You're going to the call by yourself. You have to navigate how to get to the call by yourself. You have to drive code three through intersections, try not to get in a wreck by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And also somehow arrive and seamlessly take command of an incident while you just broke all the DMV laws in the book, getting to the fire. And so what I found, one of the things, to going back to the personal responsibility you're talking about, one of my two of my favorite quotes when it comes to that, what I call decentralized leadership, where it's like you're not with them,
mm-hmm.
is number one is the art of warfare by Sun Tzu,
mm-hmm.
one of the best command books there is. He says every battle is won or lost before it's ever fought. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The planning, the training, the trust, the relationships, and all that.
That's a great quote.
It's the best. And so you look at any football team, you know, all the work that they do, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to play against this team, looking at game film, you know, just everything that we mm-hmm. do before. And as a BC, I look at the battalion chief job as like a head coach of a football team.
Mm-hmm.
Once they blow the whistle and the game is on, the kickoff happens, that mm-hmm. head coach has very little control over that football game.
Yeah.
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a battalion chief on a fire, running a fire. We're the, just like a head coach, we got our headset on or we got our radio and we're sitting mm-hmm. back here at the command post. We're not on the field anymore.
No.
But all we did to all we've invested in that team before mm-hmm. kickoff is what's going to make that fire, that event go well.
Yeah.
And same thing with the football coach. And what I've found, which is for me, it's like a major, problem with the American Fire Service that I'm seeing, is that most battalion chiefs don't understand that. They don't get that about themselves, mm-hmm. about their job.
Yeah.
That, hey, you can't rely on the training division of your fire department to train your battalion or your officers. You need to have hands-on,
mm-hmm.
full contact leadership. You have to be engaged with your officers, with your troops, doing hands-on drills, doing multi-company drills, and not just, you know, what's the chief do? We never see our chief unless
keyboard commander.
Keyboard commander.
Yeah. That's like the mantra. The hardest work is done before you arrive.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. I mean, it's you know, I always look at like, you know, where does real fireground leadership come out of? Comes out of the firehouse. You know, if you're not leading in the firehouse, if you're not engaging with the troops, if you're not doing all those things that are leading up to the success or the failure on the fire ground, you know, you can't just show up on a fire ground and expect that everything's miraculous.
And we've seen that, right. Haven't we? How many times have you seen, and we're not going to name names here, but how many times have you in your life seen a chief who had no relationship with the troops, was distant, didn't train with them, and then shows up and he's the incident commander?
Yeah.
Or he shows up and it gets up at everyone's butt because they didn't do something right in his mind.
Yeah.
And it's like, where were you the other 95% of the time? You know, that you have no right to come in and bust their stones because of what they did or didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't here. We should bust your stones for not being here and preventing it and being part of the front end of this
thing. Yeah, well, it's like, you know, a caterpillar without a head.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, no, I agree. I agree with that 100%. Like, I always looked at it like, you know what? You play the way you practice. And, exactly. You know, if you practice and the head coach is never there during practice,
right. That's it.
You know, yeah.
How are you going to win the game?
Because
the head coach is still going to want to call the plays, even though he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's still going to be out there and try and act like he knows what he's doing, even though he doesn't. And he doesn't have the trust of the troops. They haven't had the sets and reps during the week, during practice. And like my former agency, there was 5 battalion chiefs on a day, which means 15 battalion chiefs total on the floor over across 3 shifts. And, you know, we as a large 40 station agency did not have the train division. Nobody does. Nobody has the train division they need in the American Fire Service. You know, nobody has enough training officers. So the gap has to be bridged by the battalion chiefs, in my opinion. And the company officers.
Right.
But I would always, my philosophy is the company officer is the training officer for the company. The battalion chief is the training officer for the shift. Battalion.
Yeah,
the shift.
Yeah.
And what I found is that as you go around the country like you do teaching, do you find that a lot of battalion chiefs understand that? Are they hands-on full contact leaders, or are they, and this is no indictment of anybody, this is just a general impression you've gotten from all your teaching. Do you feel like battalion chiefs really understand that they need to be training officers, engaging their officers, engaging their crews, doing multi-company drills, initiating training, or they just, you know, see what the training division has for us today? Oh, nothing. I guess we're not doing anything today.
Right. Day off for training. Yeah. Those are really good points, you know, because when you don't have the leader of the team engaging with the team, how do you expect to be successful at all? Yeah, and I've seen that out there. I have seen that. And this is where, though, see what happens sometimes, too, is now you guys had the 5 battalions. Was there a deputy above that?
There was an assistant chief above that of the shift.
Our
boss was, like you, I think that was your role.
Right? I was a deputy.
Yeah.
I was a deputy. But, yeah, I was the shift commander, right. And then I had the battalions.
Yeah, so we had shift commanders, right.
Okay.
And so we had our boss, the 5 of us in the field as battalion chiefs, had our boss for our shift.
Okay.
And so... But and the good ones always were the ones who trained with us. They didn't just, you know, like I said, leadership by keyboard.
Yeah.
They didn't just hand down memos and send emails. They would get out, meet with us, talk with us, drill with us as chief officers. We would do scenarios, larger incident scenario stuff, command stuff, you know.
Yeah. The problem you run into there and I completely agree with you is when sometimes you have like a battalion and he's got too much administrative stuff to do. You know, so because battalions are like the workhorse of the department, you know,
but nobody knows it, but the battalion.
Exactly. They're like the workhorse now. So they not only have all these other dues, but they have administrative stuff that has to be done as well. Like the department gives each guy like an administrative duty. Yeah. And now you got to take care of that
facilities or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that takes away from that ability to sort of, you know,
be operational.
Be operational and you know, catch your guys doing good things and you know, pretty much like watching your guys doing good things and, you know, being present, you know, being present and being engaged. That's, you know, and engaging. I think those are really important things for chief officers. And sometimes you're right. When you come to be a chief officer, you know, sometimes they start to pull away, you know, because, there's different duties. It's a little bit, you know,
We're getting notes.
We're getting notes.
So Tony Farrell likes you.
Who does he like? Does he like me? Tony. He likes us?
His name's Tony.
That's right. Tony. He is a great guy. You know him, right?
Do I know him?
Tony Carroll?
From where?
He's from like Washington, D.C., like that area. Maybe Alexandria or Fairfax.
I think I know the name, yeah.
Something like that. I met him last year here, and I was with Frank Ritchie, and we wound up in, I think it was Nikki Blaine's, the cigar place, and we were there till like 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't smoke cigars, and but I met him there, and like, you know, he had this I don't know, this kind of shirt on. It had like some sort of crest, but it was his fire department, and I was cutting up on him so bad. I was like saying, like, what crest is that? Like, what department actually comes up with something like that, you know? And we were busting each other, you know, so bad. I haven't seen him yet here this week, so, you know, I'm hoping he is here. I'm hoping to run into him.
Yeah.
But yeah, a really, really good guy, and yeah, I've done my research on you there, Tony Carroll, and I've gotten some very good feedback about it. So it must all be true, because, you know, only probably maybe 25% of the people said you were an idiot. But I'm just kidding, brother. I'm just kidding. But yeah, I had the first time I met him, like, we hit it off. We had a good night, and it was, you know, do a fireman do.
That's right.
You know, we just, and that's one of the beauties of the FDIC, man. Oh, you know, man. Yeah, everybody's out, and it's not just the, you know, there's the show and everything else, but it's, I like to call it the beer mug case study.
Yeah.
You know, where everybody's out and everybody's talking, and, you know, where are you from? And, you know, how many guys you got on a job? What's your company's like? What kind of fires do you get? You know, like, it's just, that's what makes this place so special.
It does.
You know,
it does.
Like, unlike anything else.
Unlike anything else. Like, I've said it, and I know you have. This is where I come to get rejuvenated, refreshed.
Yeah.
You know, I look at all the amazing instructors. I look at the women's conference and all the stuff that they're doing, all the female instructors and officers that are coming through. And I look at all the everyone. It doesn't matter where you're from, how big your department is, whether you're male or female, whether you identify as male or female, whether you're whatever color your skin is. None of that matters at FDIC. All that matters is passion for the job.
Yes.
That's all that matters.
Passion for the job.
And that's one of the best things about this. Because you can go back to your department, And like a lot of people do, because this is kind of like, we're preaching to the choir when we do our classes, right?
Yes, I was just going
to
say
that. We're preaching to the choir. These are the most motivated, engaged people in their organizations. And you go back to your organization, you know, you don't always have that. You know, you got people who are going through tough times. You got people that are just kind of punching the clock. But back to what we were talking about, that you're right. A lot of battalion chiefs, I think one of the shock factors is they are inundated with administrative functions they've never had. They might not even have the skills to do because they've never had to before.
Right, right.
Right, like a budget or a facilities. You're in charge of facilities. I've never even freaking put in a sink in my house.
I'm in charge of facilities.
Yeah. So what I found, though, is even with those smaller agencies that where the battalion chiefs do have to shoulder a lot of administrative burden, I find that two things are prevalent. One is that where there's a will, there's a way. Okay, yes, I get it. If you've got administrative functions, you got to take care of it. But it takes a lot of hard work and effort and desire to get out in the field with your troops, to go be with them and train with them and work with them. But I've seen it in large departments too. Your very, very large city departments where the battalion chiefs don't have a whole lot of administrative function. They are literally just operational, because there's such a big logistical support system and administrative system around them. Like my system, I was very blessed. I could virtually focus only on operations and leadership and people each day. I know that's not the case everywhere, but you go to a lot of departments and I find a lot of battalion chiefs, even though they're not burdened with those administrative functions, they still don't go out and get out in the field.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think, you know, it's almost like, okay, well, now I'm a chief officer and I don't need to engage in, you know, that's their job.
Right.
I don't need to engage in the tactical things anymore. You know, I'm more on a strategic level, and, you know, that may be it. I mean, that's sort of the only thing I can think of. Or here's the other thing, and I've seen this, once they become a battalion, they start studying for deputy. And as the test gets closer, the less and less you see them. Because they're you know, just, you know, squirreled away in their office, and they're just studying and studying and studying. They'll come out for dinner, back in the office, and
I think, you know, both of those are true.
Yeah,
I think both of those are true. And here's, I'm going to give you my philosophy on battalion chiefs. I got four types of battalion chiefs.
Okay.
I'm going to make this as quick as I can. The first one is the guy or gal who, the minute they get promoted, the one you just described, mm-hmm. they want to promote again.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't run a fire yet. They right. haven't even been around all their companies yet. Mm-hmm. And they're already looking at the next job, yes. the next promotion, yes. the next deputy job, whatever. Mm-hmm. So where do they spend most of their time? At headquarters. Schmoozing.
Mm-hmm.
Schmoozing, having yeah. lunch, yeah. you know, trying to saddle up to the chiefs and trying to be in with them so they can be ready for the next one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't value the battalion's job, the critical nature of the battalion's
yeah, job. Yeah, which is a critical job.
Critical job.
Totally.
And then there's the other one. The opposite end of that one is the firefighter or the company officer becomes a battalion chief, but can't stand administration, doesn't buy mm-hmm. into the management team, doesn't buy into the philosophy, doesn't like the chief, and spends all their time in the opposite, in the stations, hanging out, napping mm-hmm. in the recliner, right. BSing, that's wearing it. Out their welcome,
watching TV,
yeah, yeah. and bad-mouthing administration. And then there's the one that is in neither place. They're the invisible one. They're the one they're the keyboard chiefs like you were talking about.
The ghost.
Oh, if you miss a report, they'll be on you. And mm-hmm. you're going to get a bloop on your computer. You'll mm-hmm. get an email in 2 seconds, but you never see them.
Right.
Because they're afraid of people and they're afraid of fires. This is my mm-hmm. philosophy.
This is good though. Okay. This is good.
Then there's the unicorn. The unicorn is the one who gets it. They're not looking at the next promotion. They don't care about that. It's not, but they buy into and they support the fire chief and mm-hmm. where the organization is going, but they also have street credit. And this one is the one I consider to be who understands the tactical space of a battalion's
mm-hmm.
world, that tactical space. You're not task level companies in the field. You're not strategic at headquarters. You're straddling both in the yeah. tactical space. And that requires you to be highly hostile, agile, and mobile. Hostile, they gotta be, say, you know what? This is my battalion. I'm not gonna mm-hmm. apologize for being a chief. And I'm not gonna try and be one of the guys mm-hmm. anymore because I'm not. I'm not gonna suck up to the fire chief because I'm not his level or her level. I'm gonna own my freaking battalion.
I'm gonna make you guys the
best. I'm gonna make us the best battalion mm-hmm. we can be. And I'm gonna train, or we're gonna, so they own it. They have that strong command presence. Agile. They understand where they came from. They didn't forget where they came from. They can relate to the troops and they have the respect of the troops because of it, but they also have the agility to understand where the chief's trying to go
mm-hmm.
and where the organization's going.
Sometimes is in contrast.
Yes.
You know, conflict.
I've been that guy.
Yeah.
I had
yeah.
two strokes over this crap.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the thing is that mental agility to be able to think task level, but think strategic level, you have to be an ambassador as a battalion chief, an mm-hmm. interpreter, a suicide mm-hmm. prevention hotline operator. You have to be a counselor,
yeah,
and all these things between daddy, mom.
Yeah.
You have to be in between these two levels all the time. So the troops keep them posted, but also let the chief know what's going on in the firehouses for real, and mm-hmm. back and forth. And then you have to be mobile. You can't just sit and take a pants off nap every afternoon in mm-hmm. your dorm. You have to be out and about. You have to put the most miles on your BC buggy and the most minutes on your phone, putting out fires, closing loops, helping everybody understand mm-hmm. where everyone else is at. And that's a full-time job.
Yeah.
And you can't do it if you're hiding or if you're trying to promote still.
Exactly. And then, you know, putting out fires, it's not just firefighters. Exactly. There's lots of others, administrative fires. There's personality fires. There's all that sort of thing. You know, it's interesting because I kind of look at it also in a very similar way. Three types of leaders, the rock, the bowl of jello, and the ghost. And nice. And you look at it from, so you want the chief of department to be a rock, because if the chief of department's a rock, it's very difficult for anybody else to be a ball of jello or a ghost. They're going to be held accountable.
Right.
But the thing you run into is when the chief of department is a ball of jello
yeah.
or a ghost.
Yeah.
Now the guys that are rocks, sometimes you've got rock star company offices. And they get frustrated.
Yes.
And they can yes. go one of two ways. They can get frustrated and just go into a shell.
Yep.
Or they can sort of, you know, continue. Oh, but no, they can kind of continue doing what they do, knowing that at some point these people are going to be gone.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the nicest thing I always say, you show me a great fire department, I'll show you a fire department with great company officers.
That's right.
And great company officers will almost always ensure the future of that fire department. You know,
yes, yes.
And then you have the ghost, which might actually be the worst. And I've worked under chiefs that were ghosts.
Yes.
And the chief that's a ghost, nobody knows what to do,
right,
you know,
right.
And it allows no one to be accountable for anything.
Right, right.
And no one gets any accolades, and it all, you know, all he's trying to do is his own self-preservation.
Total,
you know?
Self-preservation.
So yeah, I looked at those sort those, of three
I like that.
Things.
I like those
that,
analogies,
yeah, yeah, the ghost, the bowl of Jello, and the you know, and the rock, you know, and yeah, you know, very similar to what you're talking about. Huh. You notice there's all
these
all
analogies
different...
are great.
Yeah.
I think
analogies yeah. are great.
Yeah, yeah.
And they really are.
It
great.
Makes it easy for us to understand. And
yeah, because we're simple people.
We are. We're very simple people. I call when I talk about the task level on the fire ground, you know, I talk mm-hmm. about Mongo, and Mongo is male and female. Mongo doesn't care about anything but eating, sleeping, and breaking shit. That's it. That's it. Repeat. Eat, sleep, mm-hmm. break stuff. Repeat. You know, and Mongo likes to work. Mongo doesn't really care what's going on the radio. Mongo is not thinking tactically. Mongo just wants to freaking do stuff.
Just do stuff.
Just break go stuff. Do break stuff.
Yeah.
But Mongo needs a brain within his proximity called a company officer or a division group supervisor that can be thinking tactically for Mongo and keep Mongo's ass out of trouble.
And Mongo is somebody that will listen.
And Mongo listens.
He always listens.
You point and he'll go, you know, he'll go until you pull back on the reins, and even then mm-hmm. he'll probably keep going a little bit. And Mongo is loyal. Mongo's good, but Mongo can be Mongo's own worst enemy sometimes.
Yes.
And so we need a tactical supervisor. And if a company officer is too task saturated, like they are nowadays, because they're not running 5 and 6 person companies like FDNY, mm-hmm. but they're running 2 and 3 person companies, then guess what? The company officer gets sucked into Mongo mode too.
Mm-hmm.
And now we need, well, like we've talked about, build the beast, feed the beast. I use that term that you gave me. I love that. I tell people that. I don't give you any of the credit for it.
That's okay.
But
I didn't make that up.
You didn't?
Or did I?
No, you made Wait. It up. You I think you did.
Build no, the beast. No.
That wasn't you?
No, I got that from the guy from Philadelphia, Jimmy Smith.
Oh, okay.
I took a class called Command and Control of Fires and Emergencies. Jimmy Smith and John Lisak, I think was the guy's name. And that's what it was. Create the beast and feed the beast.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. Create the beast, feed the beast. And I got that from those guys.
I loved it because it makes sense on when you're setting up the incident command system, you're setting up ICS, build your division groups and feed them.
Yes. And feed them people and stuff.
Feed them resources. But I guess back to what we're talking about is how do we, like you said, I love the whole rock, the Jello and the ghost. How do you keep those company officers? How does it, for those listening, how do our friends out there who are company officers and they work for a ghost or they work for a bowl of Jello, how do they mm-hmm. sustain that leadership at their level without burning out or getting pissed off? Because I know for me, I've had great bosses. I've had terrible bosses.
Mm-hmm.
And my last 13 years, I was a battalion chief and I loved it. I didn't change shifts. I didn't change battalions. I loved that sweet spot of being a tactical battalion mm-hmm. chief. But in that 13 years, I had 26 bosses.
Wow.
26 different direct supervisors, which were the shift commanders, 10 different deputy chiefs ops, and 6 different fire chiefs.
Wow.
And so each time, as you know, one of them changed, my world changed just a little.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot, but sometimes mm-hmm. more than others. Great bosses, terrible bosses. I had, you know, I had ghosts, I had Jello, and I had rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through my own burnout. I had 2 strokes in that period of time because I'm an idiot. Because I'm an overachiever. Not one was good enough.
And you internalize.
Oh, I internalized it all. Oh, dang it. I'm Greek.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, come on. I was born on the wrong coast in the mm-hmm. wrong decade, the wrong century. I'm all alone out there. That's why I love coming out here and talking mm-hmm. to you guys. You know how many times people ask me, are you from the East Coast? And I always got to say, no.
Yeah, you got East Coast mentality.
Oh, man. I love it. I just love it. So that's a huge compliment. Thank you. But the point is that how do we help our listeners and friends get through those seasons when you're working for Jello or
mm-hmm.
it's a season.
Yeah.
It's not gonna last forever.
No.
But you got to stick it out while you're in that in the POW camp.
I think, and I've seen this mostly in volunteer organizations around where I work, because I see some really solid company officers and then above them, not so solid. And I think the advice I would give, because I've seen it and so I saw it work, I think you have to sort of, at your level, you need to seek out guys that are of like mind, that you can almost, confide in, build with and grow with.
Yeah.
And you might, it might be another captain.
Yes.
You know, another company officer. Sure. So that guy keeps you level. Yes. That guy keeps you on target. And you kind of almost self-regulate each other.
Yeah.
And then what happens is sometimes you're either going to, other people around you, you're either going to turn them off and they're going to drop off the radar, or you're going to pull other people up to your level. Yes. And I've seen that a bunch of times. And
yeah.
So you get this, and that's where you get like a solid officer corps.
Yeah.
And no matter what you have above them, bowls of jello or ghosts, they still can flourish at their positions, understanding that someday they're going to be moving up and they're not going to run things the way those guys that are above them are running it.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of frustration
involved
in those things. But I think that if I were to give anybody any advice about that, I would say try and seek out people that are of the same mindset of you.
Yes.
You know, and stay the course.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be forever. And you hit that on the head. It's not going to be forever. Sometimes it can't happen fast enough, and you're going to get some frustration, but you got to kind of keep your eyes on the end zone, keep your eyes on the end zone and, you know, accept the first downs every now and then and accept the penalties as well, and the sacks, football is such a great analogy.
Is. So you got your task level workers, which is the linemen, you know, and the wide receivers and all the other players. Mm-hmm. The quarterback is your company officer.
Mm-hmm.
You got your battalion chief is the head coach. That's the tactical space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got the front office, which is headquarters.
Right, which is headquarters. Exactly.
It's the best.
And if you look at the incident command structure in a football team, it's nearly the same.
It's the same.
You know, because you have the whole span of control and you have the special teams coach, the offensive and defensive coordinators. And then under them, you have all the position coaches. Yep. I mean, it's and whenever I teach ICS, I say, well, how many people understand football? And I'll say, well, this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
And now let's take this and now let's put a fire here.
Yeah.
And now let's look at this. And it's the same.
It's seamless. Yeah.
Create the monster, feed the monster. It is the same, man.
It's great.
So
I think that's great advice, though, what you said about find other like-minded officers around you, even if it's just one that you can contact, you can call, you can vent with safely. You know, you don't vent down, you vent up or laterally, and who you can say, you know what, you know, you kind of keep each other buoyant and floating through that season of trucks in the water and all the other craziness going on. But know that it's a season. It's easy to think this is how it's going to be forever.
A bad
chief or a bad boss or whatever,
get you disillusioned.
Oh man, but remember why you're here, which is, you know, going out, because the public doesn't know or care who your boss is.
No,
they don't know or care.
No,
they know, they care about you for this 20 minutes, 2 hours, whatever you spend with them. And it doesn't matter who your boss is in that period of time.
Mm-mm.
And that's really a testament, I think, to the character of a leader, is when they have dysfunctional bosses around them or above them. And you would never know it walking in their firehouse, or you would never know it going on their calls. Right. Because they just give the best.
Yeah. Give the best that there is. Listen, you know what? It's a, you know, we lose sight of this fact once in a while, but we're only in existence because the public is out there. You know, sometimes we think it's about us and it's not about us. You know, we're only here because they're out there, you know, and in the class that I do, I use a thing called the prime directive. And the prime directive is nothing shall interfere with the in-service and ready status of your command or your company or equipment. And, you know, you only got one reason that you're here, and that's to get out that door. And the public expects excellence. They don't call you because they expect mediocrity. You know, they expect excellence. And excellent, you know, and excellence is a moving target, you're not always going to hit it. And they might not even know.
Right.
But, you know, your job as an officer is to ensure the ready and in service status of your company, to make sure that they are always ready to go, that, you know, you know, if you can't get out the door, you know, like it's like, you know, you get in at 7:30 in the morning and at 7:45, you get an alarm and you're in the right front seat and you see the guys coming out of the kitchen, going to the racks to get their gear.
Exactly.
You know, you're like, what? That's a culture thing too, by the way.
That is that thing that pissed me off more than anything when I retired and I started seeing more of that.
Yeah.
Where crews would come in and not even put their stuff on the rig. They would just go right to the kitchen, start cooking breakfast.
Yeah.
Breakfast is two hours and then there's a workout or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not even checking the rigs, let alone putting their gear on anything else.
Yeah. if the first thing you do is grab a cup of coffee and sit around in the kitchen, there's a problem. There's a problem because, you know, you don't know what the status of the rig is and anything like that. And I've always sort of been of the mindset that when you have problems with, you know, on your fire ground, they're always traced back to those softer environments in the firehouse.
Absolutely.
Always. And, you know, and that's the fault of, you know, the company officer is got to be on top of that, right. You know, and I mean, the battalion chief, you want him to be present and engaged as well. But in reality, the company officer is in charge of that company. You're in charge of the players, you know, and again, you're talking about the football coach analogy, you know, you're in charge of those groups and those squads and all whatever, you know. It's important that they understand that you know, they exist for that one reason.
Yeah.
And that's just to get out the door.
To me, nothing ruins good leadership like peer pressure, you know, and that's why I like Chase Sargent's stuff, you know, his book, Buddy the Boss, that was, you know.
He was in my class this morning.
Was he?
And I never met him before. Oh, and I was like, you're the Buddy the Boss guy.
Yeah.
Holy God, I read your book, man. Yeah. But I had never met him.
Yeah. He's great.
You know, yeah, he stayed for about half hour, 40 minutes, and I guess he had to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Or I pissed him off, maybe. I don't know. Quite possibly. I'm from Hudson County, man.
Well, that's part of the job. So the thing is that I found, it happened to me, I think the biggest whack upside the head I got as a young leader was that not everybody thinks like me, right?
Mm.
They're not all here for the same reason I am. They don't all see life the way I do. They don't, because I grew up with a silver spoon, man. I grew up in a beautiful, large, loving Greek family, man. I grew up the youngest of five kids in a big, fat Greek family. We ate a lot. We yelled. We freaking, it was.
Anthony.
Get out of here. There was a lot of love, right? But my dad was like a Greek Archie Bunker. You know, my dad's opinion was law. It wasn't, he had his recliner, you know, and he had his opinions, and that wasn't opinion. It was fact. If he said something, that's how it is. He came out of World War II. Yeah, he was he was in the infantry in the Pacific in the war.
Wow.
Two Purple Hearts.
Oh.
Grew up in the Depression. Was a coal miner as a kid.
Mm.
There was no debate, discussion. Mm. There was no opinion. There was just what he said was law.
And always on the West Coast?
On the West Coast.
Oh, so grow up on the West Coast, like I can't even fathom that.
God. So I grew up in a very East Coast house,
mm-hmm.
very old traditional style.
Yeah, it sounds that way.
In the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, and here's the other thing, is that my next closest sibling was 9 years older than me.
Oh, man.
My two brothers, the oldest two, 18 and 15 years older than me. Same parents. Wow. They were married for 46 years.
So you were like treated like a puppy.
Oh, these guys, I was a puppy. I was a prince. I was a pauper. I was a piece of crap.
Your rag doll, punching bag.
Oh my God. And so I grew up at a firehouse. My brothers, by the time they're 20, 18, 20, they're volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm growing up literally in a firehouse in Carmel in an old school environment. So by the time I'm getting my sea legs as a young firefighter and stuff, I immediately can tell. And then I was a volunteer. So everyone's like-minded volunteers. We're all motivated, right? We're all young. We all want to, you know, we call ourselves the regulators. We're all volunteers, you know? And then I landed my first career job in 1991. And I instantly realized I'm not like anybody else. This is weird. I've got an old soul. I'm much more of a if you want to do generations, I'm much more of a baby boomer than I am a Gen X that I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was a volunteer coming into a career department. So I was surrounded by old guys that were pissed at the chief, and all they cared about was their mortgage. I didn't have a mortgage. I was a stupid young kid.
You know,
truck. I didn't have a pickup truck. You know, and so I just instantly was like, this is weird, you know? And then as a leader, one of the things I realized is when I become a young acting captain, then a captain, you know, you go through those oh crap moments where you go, oh, well, and you realize not everybody thinks like you, not everybody has the same values you have, not everybody likes what you like and sees the fire service and sees the firehouse and sees the job the way you do, but you're their boss.
Yeah.
So how, like you said it earlier, you got to know your people. They don't have to be just like you. They don't have to be. In fact, I don't want them to be just like me. I don't want them to be different from me, but I got to know them and respect where they're at if I can lead them. And that to me was a big frying pan upside the head, like a cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, was going, wow. That's everybody's life. Sees things the way I do. Sees the fire service. Cause to me, the fire service has been other than God and my family, the fire service was number three in my life, you know, as you
know.
Yeah, and Elvis, as you know, is the number four, the Beatles for you. But the thing is not everybody thought, you know, and so,
no.
So there was a lot of self, I do a lot of self-checking and with my intensity, with my, how demanding I was, you know, how I saw things, how I relayed things, to not alienate and piss off my crew or my battalion or whatever, to make sure they knew that, hey, look, he doesn't expect us to be just like him. He, you know, hey, we weren't raised in the firehouse like you. You know, we weren't raised in an old school East Coast home like you, and a big fat Greek family like you, the passion, all this other stuff. And I had to learn the hard way as a boss to take the best of my upbringing and my dad, if you will, in me, and then put the other stuff over here.
Kind of aside, yeah.
Because otherwise...
you wouldn't have survived.
I wouldn't have survived.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have survived.
Wow. It's interesting. Well, listen, you know what? That's what a lot of leaders have to understand as well. Look, you know what? It's not all, and you just hit it on the head. It's not all about you and what you want. It's about adjusting yourself to, you know, be the best chief you can be, but also to bring out the talents and you know, of the people that you, that work for you, you know, and you know, and again, for me, I was a young captain. The people who worked for me were older than me.
Exactly.
You know, and you know, luckily for me, most of them were very good, very understanding, but there was some that weren't, you know, there was some that were bitter, you know, and like, you know, you have to sort of, and you know, it's a slippery slope and it's a delicate dance, you know, and you have to sort of always keep your eye on the end zone, again, with the football analogy, keep your eye on the end zone, but sometimes getting to the end zone is going to be a little bit of a different path.
Well, and that's, you know, to that analogy, again, I always use the analogy. I look at like different fires. We have to approach different fires with different tactics, right?
Mm.
Well, you have to approach different people with different tactics.
Mm.
And if I'm a football coach, a head coach, and I'm facing a team that's got a really, really strong secondary, and I have a pretty weak passing game, I'm going to go with a running game.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is the same. We're going to score and we're going to win, but it's going to be a different game plan, if you will, than it would be if I had a really, really strong passing game and an all-star Tom Brady quarterback with a couple of phenomenal
wide receivers.
So you have to play, you have to know your people, and you got to play to their strengths, and you got to help them all see the end goal, but then adjust the game plan to get to that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part I think I know as my young career, I struggled with, and not even my young, throughout my whole career as a boss, 13 years as a battalion chief, 5 as a captain. There were times when I was just hitting my head against the wall. And I knew, but it wasn't because of them. It was because of me.
Mm.
Like, damn it. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't go out and lose your temper like that. You can't go out and, you know, be so impatient. You can't go out and be so opinionated. You can't go out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it comes with the Greek thing, right?
Man.
Yeah.
It's a double-edged sword, man. It's a double-edged sword, brother.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at one of the things I was saying today in the class was, ego and emotion can never exist in the same space as rank.
Oh, nice.
You know, because like that.
That was good. That was good.
That was pretty good. Ego and emotion cannot exist in the same space as rank. Something else, but well, just as rank, you know.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, you can't, because
that's cool.
When your ego gets involved, you never resolve anything.
You're done.
And when your emotion gets involved, you know, you're all over the place, and you become part of the problem, you know. So, you know, leadership is all about subjugation of ego.
That's
all it is. And it takes a lot of courage, man.
Oh, man.
A lot of courage, especially when you're dealing with people that are emotional and people that are egomaniacs. And listen, you know, this fire service is filled with egomaniacs. But you know what? Those egomaniacs a lot of times become frustrated. They make mistakes. They get themselves in trouble. You know, and that's one of the things, you know, I learned from Flood. He's like, listen, it's always just about business. It's not about anything else. And you know, your emotions cannot play a part. Your ego can never play a part. But your rank has to be, you know, there's tremendous responsibility there. You know, it trumps everything else.
Yeah.
You know, you know, I learned a lot from that guy. I learned a lot. And I resisted a lot. You know, a zillion friggin' times, you know, but in the end of the day, you know, I learned a real lot from the guy. And, you know, and it's interesting, at the very end of my class, I found a video on my computer. You know how we do the videos for the FDIC? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, a little yeah, sort little of snippet. Teaser.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when we did the class 2 years ago, he did one, but he sent it to me and I forgot I had it. So I was going through my computer and I came across this thing. And what it is, it's him reading the last little thing in the book called The Perspective Parable. And it's him reading it. It's not all complete, so I usually have to read the end of it, but I finish out the class with it. And it's really, you know, because I talk about him through the whole class. And I said, you know, like, listen, I found this thing. It was a gift, you know, and the perspective parable is like, once upon a time was a firefighter, and the firefighter was sitting on the grass next to a gently flowing river, looking at a verdant, lovely forest, and all things were well. Above him on the rock is the company officer. He can see the firefighter on the shore, the gently flowing river, the verdant forest, and he can see shadows moving in the forest. Above him is the battalion chief. The battalion, he's on a hill. He can see the captain on a rock, the firefighter on the shore, the river, the forest, and he can also see the shadows and see dust rising above. On the hill is the deputy. The deputy can see them all down below, and he can see everything they see, but he can also hear a distant, ominous rumble. On top of the mountain is the chief, who can see all the guys down below, all the other things, but what he sees is 7,000 Macedonians armed to the teeth on war horses running through the forest to create havoc upon every battalion, division, and company in your department.
It's
all about perspective, where you are and what you can see, you know? It's the perspective parable. It's the end of the book. But I found a video of him actually reading it. And that's what I use at the end of the book, at the end of the class. And it's really cool. It was a gift that, like, somehow I didn't know it was on my computer. I just came across it one day, you know, and I said, holy shit.
Yeah.
I said, you know, so I have like 4 copies of it, and I have it on a hard drive. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
That'd be awesome.
Definitely. Cause it's really good. And it's just him. And he goes, well, the reason behind this hostage video, he goes, is, you know, and he's talking about the book, and it really rounded the class out, you know, and it made it, it brought it like full circle, you know, and I had a lot of really, really good feedback on it, you know? So yeah, I'm excited about it.
That's a big deal, man.
I'm excited about it. So we've been going about an hour here, but we have to touch on one more thing.
Sure.
The command post. Because this is where we've started.
This is the whole time has been leading up to this moment.
I think it has. And we'd be remiss if we didn't spend a few minutes here. So maybe each of us take a minute or two to talk about what you think, and then we get the point, the counterpoint.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe
good.
So.
Okay.
You're the guest.
I'll go first.
You're the guest.
Okay. And I brought this up yesterday in my command class. I go, Avilo says, I tell people, I always bash you.
Oh, so do I.
Yeah, it's perfect. So the whole premise of, so everyone listening, watching, whatever, our little difference of opinion here is where is the command post? Where is it? And how do you set it up? For me, I can honestly say, and this is no exaggeration, in 13 years as a battalion chief in a relatively busy system, I can't remember one time where I got out of the vehicle to set up command on a structure fire. Now, large vegetation fire, hundreds of thousands of acres, multiple homes. Yes.
We don't have large vegetation.
I know. MCIs, hazmats, unified command. Yes. Go to the back, whatever. But for the structure fires, I can honestly say I don't remember 13 years ever getting out of the vehicle. I didn't get out and do a lap and come back. I didn't get out and stand in the front. Why? The reason was, going back to what I said earlier, every battle is won or lost before it's ever fought.
Mm-hmm.
I placed a tremendous amount of trust on my company officers. But with that trust came an immense amount of training. I trained with them constantly. I did individually, collectively as officers, multi-company drills, hands-on drills, simulations, tabletop. We built tabletop models, just constantly, mm-hmm. constantly training, tactic, so that we were of the same mindset, so that I trusted them to be my eyes and ears. I didn't get out of it because I didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that geographically, you know, obviously Jersey and California are way different as far as the streets and the buildings and the layout. I've got much wider streets, you know, I can park and all this and probably much more readily than you could. So that's, I'm sure, a lot of it. But for me,
could you still see everything where you are?
Sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't.
Okay.
It just depended on the fire and the building and the and so forth. There's plenty of fires I saw nothing. There's plenty of fires I was across the street, saw the Alpha side, no problem. Got videos of both. But it was all predicated upon an immense amount of trust of my company officers, but not just because I told them to, because we trained constantly. We, in 13 years, I think I recorded every fire I had for probably 12 of those 13 years. I've got them all. And all the audio, all the video. So I had game film of every fire.
Wow.
Game film. And audio of not only the all the transmissions on the tactical channel, but what was happening at the command post, you know, a dialogue or my own thoughts, somewhere I would think out loud or say something or cuss somebody out for parking in the wrong spot or something. And so it was very transparent. So our reviews of the fires were based upon actual audio of the fires, actual video of the fires. And then as firefighters got more and more advanced with their you know, cameras on their helmets and this kind of stuff. But it was all because I trust my officers to be my eyes and ears. And so I was very forward thinking and proactive in my use of the incident command system. I set up groups and divisions more proactively than most of the other chiefs in my system. All very good chiefs, but I chose to look. I said, look, if I'm going to a house fire, for example, I'm already at 15 to 1 span of control going to a house fire. 15 to 1, just driving there. I had four engines. I had two trucks that could easily split. So that's nine. I had another chief and I had a medic unit. That's 10 to 1. Well, in route, I've still got to drive code 3. I've got a command channel, a tactical channel. I've got the MDT and I've got maps that I've got to train. So I've got a 15. My brain is going in 15 directions, literally. When I arrive on scene, I have to land on a rolling pitching aircraft carrier at night in a windstorm and a rainstorm. And I'm not the only airplane landing. There's other ones coming behind me. So with all that going on.
You are good at analogies, man.
Thank you, brother. So I knew this was going to come someday. So I haven't prepped for this, but I've thought about it a lot.
Okay.
And so I didn't think about when I talked to Anthony about this. No, but you know, my point is I've thought a lot about the command post and I've thought a lot about things and why I did what I did for all those years. And back to the battles won or lost before it's fought. We had done so many scenarios and so many different out of necessity, out of making huge mistakes. I lost two kids and a dad on an apartment fire when I was like a 1 year BC. And that bore a hole into my soul. And from that came all this curriculum for a command. It was born out of that pain. And then we had redemption 4.5 years later when we saved that little guy on El Camino. And so I knew that I had to reduce that span of control really quick. And by doing so, I couldn't wait for the second chief to come. I couldn't say, because one, I didn't have a lot of chiefs. There's five of us, but in a large 470 square miles, five chiefs.
Yeah, they could be anywhere.
You know, they could be on their own fires, rush hour traffic, morning or evening, you know. So you just didn't have the overhead support. So I had to instill in my company officers the ability to be very agile. You might be task level on this fire. You might be making a hallway with your crew and that's all you're doing. You're Mongo mode. You just, okay. You may be in command until I get there, but you also might be tactical. I might need you to run Division Alpha or Division 3 or Division Charlie, because this fire is growing quick. We're on scene and we're already behind the curve. I'm calling a deuce on arrival. So this is going to double everything, the radio traffic potential, the accountability problems, the span of control problems, the risk assessment issues, the resource management issues. And I can't wait for the chiefs to show up. Okay. It'd be like saying, well, every fifth fire engine has 5-inch on it. So every fifth fire engine can give you a water supply. The other four can't. No, I can't do that.
Right.
So I needed my officers to have the ability to either function as task, tactical, or strategic. And I told them, I said, look, what we need to do for our fires to go well is to bridge the tactical gap between me and Mongo. I'm out here at the command post, and the command post can be 150 feet away. It could be 20 feet away. It doesn't matter.
you can be in the front lawn and still have a gap, as you know, between you and the crew's work. They're on the third floor, second floor, back, this basement. You don't know what's going on. You don't see what they, you know, what's going on. They don't see what's going on. So I needed to bridge the gap rapidly, and which would reduce the span of control, enhance the ability to have accountability, reduce radio traffic, keep the span of control down, and have maximum risk assessment instead of just it all going through me on one tactical channel, right? So garden variety house fire would typically, I'd typically set alpha. If I had a crew on the roof, that'd be roof. And I had a medical group set up, just medical and Rick. So I would take my 10-1 and reduce it to 4-1 within literally 2 to 3 minutes of arrival.
Okay.
And what that allowed me to do was stay in my buggy because now I'm in what I call the then what if phase. Mongo at the task level is in the now. Right now I'm stretching a hose. Right now I'm making this door. Right now I'm searching this room. They're just tunnel vision.
Mongo is only now.
Mongo's only knows now. I passed Mongo is next. That's the tactical space, as you know. That's the sweet spot. That's where the battle is won or lost in the tactical space, right? And so back to football, it's that quarterback. How did Brady go, you know, to the Buccaneers and take him to the Super Bowl his first year? Because of the tactical. Okay. And so that is the sweet spot. And I'm at the what? Strategic. So if we're all in alignment, Mongo's free to work and break shit is all he wants. But right behind him is the guy next up on the mountain, tactical, who sees what's really going on. Mongo can't see anything because he's head down working. Tactical sees what's really going on. Vent point ignition, potential flashover, potential collapse, changing conditions, all this stuff. I don't see that because I'm either too far away, not parked in the right spot, or even I've been on fires where I have been from here to her from the fire. I can show you a video of it. Where I'm missing stuff.
And you're missing stuff.
Because I'm in command. I got the world coming and I'm trying to retract stuff and talk on the radio and I'm missing what's happening right in front of my face. I have videos of stuff happened that I never saw in real time. But after the video, I went, oh my God, look what I missed.
Look at that, right?
So I needed that tactical supervisor to be my eyes and ears on the front or the back or the roof. Just two or three of them. And that allowed me to be not in the now, not in the next, but in the then what if.
Right. Right.
So now, Mongo break wall, put water on fire now. Next, tactical says, I need another hose line, or I need a secondary surge, or I need vertical vent, or whatever. Then what if? Then I need a second alarm. Then I need medical. What if I have a firefighter down? What if we have an explosion drop? What if it goes to the second floor? That allowed me to step back, and back meaning in the buggy. Because now I was insulated from sound, noise, everybody's opinion, everybody's swinging by, want to talk about what they did on their day off and all this other bullshit that totally detracted from my job.
Right.
So by staying in the cab, I literally put the windows up, locked the door, and just, I wanted quiet so I could focus on the radio traffic and the tone of their voices. If there was a Viber alert going off in the background, be right there by my mobile data computer and just be able to catch up on stuff and be able to be here ahead of it. Without the tactical supervisors, without them bridging the gap, yes, I probably would have been more apt to be out of
closer.
Yes. But because of all the work before the battle, they gave me the luxury. And because of our trust, it's because to me, there's a formula. Training plus time equals trust. We put a lot of training and time in that allowed me to move further away from that. That was why.
You really thought about this, haven't you?
Yeah, all the time.
Very good. I'll tell you why.
And it wasn't just for this conversation.
No.
I teach this because people ask in my classes, why are you in the buggy? Why is this? Why that? And I wanted to really be able to articulate in a class, you know, or on a video or whatever.
No, listen, you did that great, man. All right. I disagree with all of it. No, I'm just kidding. Don't spit out the water. So we're not that far apart. I would be out of the car and I would be at the command post. But see now where you had the battalions that were maybe, you know, 40 miles away, my jurisdiction was 7 square miles.
Yeah.
So we would respond with 4 and 2. I'd come in as the deputy. I already have a battalion there.
Yeah.
And the battalion would be in charge first.
Yeah.
While, you know, the captains and Mongo would be inside, right? The battalion would be in charge and I would get there and I would change information with him, and I would put him as where you were your tactical person.
Yep.
Mine would be a battalion chief.
Perfect.
Doing basically the same job.
Yeah, sure.
But that would leave me now at the command post waiting for people to come in. A second alarm would bring me another battalion chief. But if most of our battalion chiefs, when they heard what was going on,
they started gravitating.
They knew we were going second alarm. So did most of the companies, you know, when you heard that first size up report. So he's coming in, and I know I'm going to plug him into the next area I need. One of the things we did was when we said working fire, second battalion was dispatched. It used to be second battalion on second alarm. But what we did to sort of give us that supervision sort of like extra layer, we dispatched as soon as you said work and fire, the second battalion's on the way. If it was daytime, I had more battalions coming out of headquarters and even more deputies. But that next battalion coming would go in the next area that I needed coverage. But as you said, you use these tactical captains. If the battalion wasn't on the scene yet or not available and I had to get somebody in the exposure, or, you know, my roof was always my ladder captain, unless it was extensive roof operations, right. Then I'd have a battalion there.
Sure.
But I would use a captain tactically
sure. In
those buildings, but I would then, as quickly as I can, try to relieve him with a battalion chief, because I would
do the same thing.
I would so much rather have an eyes on, hands off guy.
Yes.
To allow that captain sort of to do his work.
Yes.
I always was of the mindset and that the most experienced eyes should be on the fire. And that's, you know, and again, that was part of my training and everything else. Again, I trusted my officer, trusted my battalions, and they always, you know, over time, you know, like when you look at the progress reports, one, they know you're going to ask. Two, they know what you want to hear. And three, they know what they want to say, right? So I would always sort of be at that command post, which was sort of that focal point. But yes, one of the things you were talking about, you're right. There was a lot of bombardment of outside sort of distraction, you know, companies coming into the command post, one of the directors coming over, you know. And so, yeah, I could see your side of it there.
And I appreciate what you said, understanding, because you had a 7 square miles. My battalion, mm-hmm. battalion was 35 square miles.
Yeah.
Very densely populated.
Yeah. Right?
So we could easily have two more battalions in the system easily. Mm-hmm. But again, even with traffic and everything, I can't tell you how many times we had the victim out or knocked down before the second chief even got on scene.
Oh, yeah. Same with us, because right. We have the traffic. I mean, our streets are like this.
Yeah, the streets are like that. Yeah.
But they were coming from closer by, and if they weren't out on an alarm already, they were already on their way, you know, which made a difference, you know. And I was always of the mindset, you know, I think I told you, know, Vince Lombardi never coached the game from the locker room,
right?
You know, that to me, I'm saying, you know, and command presence requires command to be present,
right? Right.
So those are the other things that I looked at, and this was, you know, sort of the you know, the philosophies that were instilled in me,
sure.
You know, coming up. And I talked to Brunicini about it too. And I told him about the thing. I said, well, Vince Lombardi never coached the game from the locker room. I think I might've used Bill Cowher at the time, never coached the game from the locker room. And he laughed about that. He said, well, that's a very good point. He said, but you know, he threw something else at me that was, you know, we were basically saying, well, we're a little bit different than football.
Yeah.
But he was also a big football fan, too. He understood all his football philosophies as well.
Very physical,
you
know?
But, yeah, I agree with a lot. I think we're doing a lot of the same things.
Sure.
I think the issue is, one, the proximity of the next layer of supervision,
mm-hmm.
whereas you might have to use a captain to do what I'd be using a battalion for
until
you got a battalion to do that.
Yeah.
Because I was sort of, and I still am, of the mindset that captains, if they're going to be hands on, eyes on, I'd want somebody there with eyes on, hands off.
I totally agree.
That sort of can, you know.
Agreed.
So,
in a perfect world, yeah.
Yeah.
But my I have a thing I call the ICS formula,
mm-hmm.
and it's the building, the conditions, and the resources. Building conditions, that's a no-brainer. The resources is the biggest variable in the American fire service, right? Not just how many you get and what your staffing is.
How long.
But how long it takes. And that's the biggest thing. And so when I teach my command class, like yesterday, you'll get a volunteer department. Hey, I got two guys every 6 years, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not getting 37 guys in 12 seconds. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you have to do it different. So, and so, but it affects everything. It could commit, it could affect your command post location.
Sure.
The building type could affect that. The streets, all mm-hmm. that stuff.
All that affect stuff. All.
Yeah. So I think the intent is the same. We both recognize the big picture, which is what there's a Mongo. Mm-hmm. Mongo needs tactical supervision,
mm-hmm.
and we need to stay ahead of the incident.
Right.
And to do that, we need to decentralize as mm-hmm. much as we can.
Yeah.
What I found, the ancillary benefits, what I found was that it made them better officers.
Yes.
It made them better officers.
And it also probably prepared them for the next level.
Exactly. So I have a joke because I show this video. I'm going to show it to you because I think you'll enjoy it. It's a video of a townhome fire I have. And it's a hot ass day. It's like 110 degrees and it's 2 p.m. And that's the other reason I stay in the car, because the air conditioning. But anyway, we'll get back to that later. So the first in gets there. They've got a working townhome fire. He's got an engine and truck arrive. They go to work. Second engine captain comes in. He assumes command from the first captain. He assumes command. He's in command when I arrive. He's getting water supply established, more lines on the ground, yada, yada. I come in. Now there's three engines on scene and a truck. I come in, me, a second truck, and then the balance alarm's coming in. Hot day, good working fire in the attic of a attached townhome. And I take the kid who was the kid, the captain, who's great job. He was in command. We do a quick transfer and I say, you're now alpha. And I go, you got everybody inside working for you. Your objective, fire, tech, and search.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to set up roof above you. Rick Medical will be golden. So he did a fantastic job. Well, he's a brand new captain. You can see in the video. I always pause the video and I go, how long do you think he's been a captain? Shiny red helmet, nothing on it. You know, and I go, this is his first time being in command of a structure fire. And now it's about to be his first time running a division on a structure fire. I go, but I have trained him. We have spent countless hours in realistic conditions training him. And I trust him. He just doesn't trust himself yet.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's been doing this with floaties on. We're taking the floaties off and he's jumping and I'm kicking his ass into the deep end of the pool right now because this is going two alarms. And so he's got, I pause him as he's walking by in front of my windshield.
Mm-hmm.
You see him pause and his face like this, you know, like, oh shit. You know? But I know he can do it. I
right. know he you got can more, do it. More I, confidence in him than he more, has in himself.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So we sat there. Yeah. 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 So it's funny about, I don't know how, probably several minutes later, the second chief shows up way later. Okay. And so this, the division alpha comes out, he goes and he's doing everything perfectly. He comes out to the command. He comes, walks out back to my command post, which is, I don't know, 75 feet away, 50 feet away, whatever it is. Probably say 500 feet away, whatever it is. And you see this whole thing, you see him come and you hear, as he's walking towards me, you hear, primary search all clear. Primary search clear. It's one of his crews. Mm-hmm. One of his task level Mongos is saying, we got our primaries clear. And as he's walking towards me, he goes like this. And he's walking to talk to me. Now, I'm tempted to do what? Command copies. No, no, no. If I do that, I've just taken him out of the picture. I've mm-hmm. undercut his authority.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's going to go around him to me now. I don't want that. I want them because the radio traffic's nice and quiet because they're all, mm-hmm. he's talking to them face to face. So he comes, the window comes down and he wants to, and I go, tell everybody you heard that. He goes, Division A copies primary clear. And then I say, command copies primary clear. So that's, we're all in alignment, right? Mm-hmm. It's going through him. And he goes, there's too many guys up there. You know what I said to him? Fix it. And you see him just turn. He just goes right back. And the whole time he's thinking, that son of a mother frick, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's hot as hell. And he's thinking, I just wasted my time.
Yeah.
And, but guess what happened the next?
He grew.
The next fire. Yeah, Battalion 7, this is Engine 108. Why don't you make a Division Alpha on this? I'll take Engine 2, 3, 4, and Truck 5 for you, right? A couple fires later. Yeah, I'll go ahead and keep Command Chief if that's good for you. You know, then it's, Chief, why don't you retire and get the hell out of here? You know, that's, you're building yeah, them,
confidence,
right?
Man.
Yeah, they're getting confidence. That experience, yeah. That's an extra added benefit of that proactive ICS mm-hmm. usage.
Mm-hmm. So. That is good. Yeah, not much different than what we're using. No, it's all about the decentralization.
Totally.
You know?
Right.
When you don't decentralize, you get overwhelmed so quickly, so quickly. Yeah. So.
And Jocko Willink, right? From his book, Extreme Ownership, one mm-hmm. of the main principles is decentralized command.
Yeah.
Military does it.
Yeah.
You know, hell,
Yeah.
And but you see so many, and I think I can feel the culture is changing in the fire service. I don't know if you feel that too, but it seems like chief off battalion chiefs are starting to be more progressive about decentralizing their fires, you know.
We've been doing it for a long time, but I work in Monmouth County where there's a lot of volunteer departments, and some of them are trying to do it. But what happens is these are guys who've been in the classes, but the guys that haven't been in the classes,
they don't know.
Right. So they're showing up and they got no gear on or anything like that.
No catcher.
Pitching with no catcher. Exactly. And, you know, and I'll say to them, look, you know, you guys have got to talk about this before the fire. This can't. And the other end is all the mutual aid, because they all do mutual aid. God. And I'm like, you guys have to talk as mutual aid groups before the fire, because, you know, if you got your operation's going smoothly and then mutual aid comes in and it goes into the tank, I said, that's your fault. Right. I said, you guys have to have this, like, mutual aid policy or something, you know. When the team ain't on the same page, the play goes nowhere.
Nope. So that's that whole Sun Tzu thing.
Yeah.
My other favorite quote is from Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You think about all he did for D-Day and all the planning, and what I love about his, because this shows the balance between planning and flexibility, which is what we need, right? He said, "I have found in battle that plans are useless, but planning is indispensable."
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Know what else he said? He said, pull on a string, it'll follow you anywhere. Push on a string, it goes nowhere.
Exactly.
He said that too.
What do you think?
All brother? Right, brother. Yep. Yeah, listen.
I have one quick message from Jim Duffy.
Hi, Jim.
Okay.
He says, please don't replace me with Ando. Listening on my headphones.
Oh, boy. Duff, listen, man.
You're irreplaceable, bro.
You are irreplaceable, man. Listen.
We'll start our own show, but you won't be on that. But, I mean.
Listen, you know, like, listen, my East Coast loyalty will always be with you, Duffy. I mean, he's just a West Coast interloper here. But I have to say, this was a great show. I'm sure you agree. Thank you for coming on. This was so cool. We finally got this, like, you know, command post thing.
You know.
Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, so if any of you people that have any decision-making process about a great big room session between me and my good friend Chief Castros, this little session should convince you. Anyway, I'd like to thank Fire Engineering, Clarion, and everybody for having us here. Thank you, Tammy.
Thanks, Tammy.
And thank you, everybody else. Anthony, thank you so much, brother. For being here, man.
This was
really good. And listen, everybody,
Tony and Tony show.
Hey, Tony. Listen, everybody, have a great month. Great rest of the summer, nice and safe, and enjoy the rest of the FDIC. Hopefully, some other people are listening. And we love you all, man.
God bless.
You want to say? Oh,
thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Tammy. Thanks, Bobby. Thanks, Diane. Thank you, brother. This was a great time. Great way to spend the afternoon. God bless, everybody.
Thank you.